given the limited amount of time that we have today, I want to go ahead and start taking some of the preliminary steps towards getting us to this Fisher proof that I keep mentioning over and over and over and over and over again. In order to do that, I need to give you a little bit of background information. So, just on a practical level, if you had Coke, Pepsi, whatever your favorite drink is, but the real quote-unquote version of it versus the diet version of it, if you were to spill one or the other on your floor, your carpet, whatever, which of the two you're going to be more annoyed at cleaning up? I would tend to say the regular. Why? Which one's actually going to be really that sticky afterwards? The regular one, right, with sugar? By extension, what I'm really getting at is that sugars in general are difficult compounds to work with because you get just a little bit water in them and they make this sticky mess that doesn't necessarily easily crystallize out. Now, let's roll back to the 1800s where things like melting points were really important determinations because some of these compounds were identified just on the basis of their melting points. Well, if you ended up with some kind of gel or goo that you couldn't turn into a crystal to melt, well, then how could you identify the compound? The answer is you couldn't. And so carbohydrate chemistry was something of a difficult endeavor until this reagent came along. Which is the reagent phenylhydrazine. Hydrazine you've seen before. Hydrazine you'll see in the lab today, or saw in the lab today. But this is a derivative of it, phenylhydrazine. Why does this molecule matter? Well, it turns out that if you take something like glucose, which from top to bottom, which way do the OH groups go? For glucose, D-glucose. So in other words, the OH groups are right, left, right, right. Okay. This is D-glucose. If you react this with three equivalents of phenylhydrazine, you make a product that, it's a little tricky here. The bottom three stereocenters of this product are unaffected. The top stereocenter ends up getting converted into a functional group. I want to see if anybody happens to remember what the name of this functional group that I just wrote would be. With the nitrogen double bond and the other nitrogen on it. A hydrazone, that's right. So the hydrazine makes a hydrazone, but not just with that carbon, with the neighboring carbon as well. This has leaving a carbon out. There we go. The synthesis of this hydrazone is a fascinating mechanism, which I'm going to actually email you all a handout of because the mechanism goes on for quite a while. I'm not going to ask for this mechanism on an exam, but I would like you to read through it just because you should be able to understand it. It's a variety of protonate open attack deprotonate steps, along with some tautomerization, along with a little bit of the equivalent, you could say, of decarboxylation. It's not decarboxylation, but that's what it'll look most similar to. The point of this osazone, which is a particular kind of derivative, an osazone is a double phenylhydrazone that comes from sugar. That's why it's got that os name in it. These osozones are crystalline. You might say, so what? Well, if it's a crystal, that means we could melt it and measure its melting point, which means we could identify a compound by it. And we never did do this last quarter. We never did do the synthesis. But at some point we learned about these hydrozones, and I think I talked about how derivatives in general used to be prepared to help you identify a compound. Because if we weren't dealing with sugars, if we had just some other random compound that did have a nice measurable melting point, even if you had that, you might have 10 other compounds that have that same melting point. Make a derivative of it, though, and match that derivative's melting point as well, and then that's confirmation evidence of the compound you're trying to identify. And that's how these were used as well, because you got these nice crystalline materials out of this otherwise sticky mess that you would get when you did carbohydrate reactions. But there's one issue with this. What is the structure of D mannose? Now the quiz is over. The test is coming. You're going, I mean, it's like, wow, Dr. Gray, you're the king of the obvious right here. But the point is, I'm going to ask you all the names of all the sugars that I mentioned, all of them. So if you don't start doing your memorization routine, whatever it happens to be, then it's going to be a little painful on the exam. I'm going to say it again, because I don't want anyone to say, you didn't tell us, you're going to have to know that. You're going to have to know every sugar's structure and name that I present in lecture. All right. So this, yes, is D mannose. Notice that if I took the same three equivalents of phenylhydrazine and make the phenylhydrazone, I get the same compound out. Because notice that the bottom three stereocenters in glucose and mannose match each other. And those three stereocenters are the only stereocenters that survive in this product. Since they're the same, two different compounds can make the same derivative. Not unheard of, but structurally important, because if back in the 1800s they didn't know what the structures of any of these things were, well, this is a piece of evidence that shows that these two compounds are structurally related to each other. In fact, it was from the fact that the osozones of D-glucose and mannose are identical that Fischer realized they're epimers. Because there's one stereocenter that's left, and if it's that stereocenter disappearing that identifies, that makes these the same, well, that's an epimer right there, one stereocenter difference. This is not the only way that he knew this to be true. I think at some point in introducing sugars to you, I really, really quickly went through what is known as the Kiliani-Fischer chain extension. The original version of which is in this handout that I'll be sending you all, but a modified version that's what I showed you in the lab. Now, what is the structure of arabinose? Well, there's two ways you can remember it. To memorize your ribose, arabinose, xylose, and lysose, and then do it the binary method. Or, after this lecture, you're going to realize that arabinose is chemically related to both glucose and mannose, because its three stereocenters match those same three bottom stereocenters that are in glucose, mannose, and their common osozone. So, here is this Kiliani-Fischer synthesis, and this is the same Fischer that we're talking about. This is modified to use more modern reagents. So first thing is hydrogen cyanide. which makes what kind of functional group out of the carbonyl? Some of you got this right already before. A cyanohydrin. What does it do to the carbonyl's configuration? Well, we get one more carbon and we get one more stereocenter. So we got just enough time for me to briefly do this. To remind us all what a cyanohydrin is, we can have a protonation. Which means cyanide can now attack. I'll do the attack and open in one step, because it just involves resonance. But when I attack, I'm creating a tetrahedral carbon, which means I've got a new stereocenter. Which means I'm going to have two different compounds which, having just drawn them up above, we will hopefully recognize these as almost being glucose and mannose. Of course, right after the reaction, they're not quite glucose and mannose yet, because we have a nitrile up top instead of an aldehyde. But if I then use where'd it go? Palladium with lead sulfate. That is one of those poisoning agents that I have mentioned in the past that will diminish the reactivity of palladium and allow you to stop at the double bond when you reduce the nitrile. Which, when we hydrolyze an imine, because that's what we've made now, that will make Gesundheit, D-glucose and D-mannose. So there are two ways in which the structures were demonstrated to be related somehow. Again, if you take glucose and mannose and make this osazone derivative of the two, it shows they must have somehow come from some common carbon source. We've just now shown that by chain extension, by adding one more carbon, it causes glucose and mannose to be made. And from both directions, it shows they're epimers. Because arabinose, you're only adding one carbon, you're adding one stereocenter, and it's by the difference of that one stereocenter alone that you make glucose versus mannose. And when you remove that stereocenter by making the derivatives, you've again made them the same compound again. Let me write exactly what I said just now down, and then I'll take questions. The Chiliani-Fischer chain extension of arabinose. Demonstrates that glucose and mannose are epimers.
formed by adding one stereo center. To Arabinus.
The formation of oszozoans show that glucose and mannose are epimers.
Since the stereocenter that differentiates the compounds is lost upon oszozoan formation.
So, Fisher took this and several other observations, put them together to come up with what is the structure of each of these sugars. And you already know the first step of this proof, that he made a random guess. But we've also just demonstrated this much, that starting with arabinose, where if you don't really know what its structure is, but we're assigning it a configuration for its body stereocenter. And we're creating two new compounds where, because we're adding a stereocenter, we know one has its top stereocenter configured one way, the other has that top one the opposite way. Well, that means there's just two more stereocenters that we have to determine the configuration of, at least to get the pair of glucose and mannose. Now, of course, once we figured out the pair, then we got to figure out for the top stereocenter, which way is glucose, which way is mannose. And that's where we're going to be going Wednesday. We're going to go ahead and jump into and complete this proof, since we got all the pieces to go ahead and do it. And then we'll come up and pick up the other aspects of carbohydrate chemistry. Now, the one thing I want to leave you this with is a question. Is this compound meso? No, because what do you have to have to be meso? Have to have symmetry. And even though the two OH groups, you might be able to draw a mirror plane through there, the top and the bottom, they're two different functional groups. But what if I oxidized? What was the sugar I wrote? Erythrose. If I make erythritic acid, which is what you get when you oxidize, this is what's called an aldaric acid. There's aldonic, aldaric, alduronic. And we'll learn what those are on Wednesday as well. Is that meso? Yes, it is. Because it's symmetric. So here are the types of tricks that Fisher played. Some sugars, when you oxidize them, will be symmetric. Some won't. That he could determine. If we already knew the bottom stereocenter in this compound was on the right, if we knew when we oxidized it was
optically inactive, then we know the top stereocenter is also on the right, because that's the only way it could be optically inactive. So now that the quiz is over, start reading about the Fisher proof, because that's where we're doing on Wednesday.